Welcome back to the guidebook, everybody. It's your host, Rachel. I am stoked for today's episode with Austin Church. I have been wanting to interview Austin for a while. You might know him from his newsletter, Freelance Cake, or from his presence on LinkedIn. He's a writer, marketing consultant, and business coach. And he's also part of the Layoff to Freelance pipeline, as am I. He started freelancing back in 2009 after finishing a master's in literature and getting laid off from a marketing agency. But over the past 15 years, he's really turned that around. He made over $1.8 million as a creative entrepreneur, while, as he says, learning what not to do. Don't we all? He teaches freelancers and consultants how to find their income and lifestyle sweet spot, aka set your rates appropriately. He lives in Knoxville, Tennessee with his wife, Megan, and their three kids. And today we are talking about free money, his pricing and money mindset guide for consultants and freelancers. In this conversation, we really dove into a lot more than just money mindset for freelancers and how you can set your rates accordingly. We also talked about the strategic advantages you can find in your own freelance and consulting businesses. We talked about juggling your freelance business with your life and so much more. If you're wondering about your rates, this is a great episode for you. Let's dive in and talk to Austin Church right now.
This is The Guidebook. We're sharing tips for freelancers, raw conversations with risk takers, how to become a digital nomad, and the emotions behind it all. I'm your host, Rachel. On the show, I share everything I've learned in the past 5 years of freelancing and living nomadically, showing you how you can work to live instead of living to work. I'm interviewing some of my favorite digital nomads and entrepreneurs to help you unlock your bravest self. If you want to become a freelancer or a digital nomad, this is the podcast for you.
Ooh, I should probably say that to people too, right? Don't say anything incriminating right now, please.
I think there's something really to be said to your point earlier of like the persistence. Because I feel like a lot of people give up after that first outreach and getting a no or a not right now. And I think that's a problem that a lot of my coaching clients face is they'll come to me and they'll be like, well, no one's responding to me. And I'm like, dude, I followed up with somebody like 6 times and they didn't respond to me a single one of those 6 times. But on the 7th time, they were like, your persistence, thank you. This is perfect timing. This is what I needed.
So on that note, I listened to Zig Ziglar's audio course on sales, which is fascinating because it's an audio course.
Yeah.
And he's got this Texas drawl, which kind of makes it a cultural experience in its own right. But he, and I don't know where he pulled this statistic, but it was something like, you know, most of your sales are going to come after 5 follow-ups.
Yes.
And that has been my experience. And I look back at lots of projects and consulting engagements closed. And I look back and I'm like, if I hadn't stayed in touch, then I never would have gotten the project. And then here's the other thing. Most of my time now is spent being a fractional CMO, so a part-time marketing leader, right? And so I'm on the other side now.
Of getting all those follow-ups.
Right, because we'll need a designer or a developer, or we need a writer, or we need someone to take one big video file and whatever, right? I work with tons of freelancers, and it's really interesting to me which ones stay in touch and which ones don't, because my priorities shift all the time, and I'll have freelancers who are like, hey, you know, where are we with that project that we discussed? And I'm like, I'm so sorry. It has slipped down in our priorities. We'll probably look at that again Q2 of next year. So if you want to touch base with me then, and then no joke, I may not even think about it.
Of course. You have other things
for another 4.5 months. And then if they touch base, let's see, that would be like May of next year, right? Right before Q2. I mean, it might be like, great, let's start that. So I can attest that like people, they're not following up with you because you're terrible. Yeah. Your proposal sucks. You know, they hired someone else who's cheaper and more talented. Chances are they're not hiring up with you because someone else, something else, or maybe someone else took precedence. Yeah. And so if you remember that, then you don't have to get stung when you don't hear, you just cheerfully keep following up, you know, assume the answer is yes until you get a clear.
Exactly.
No.
Exactly. The amount of times that someone has genuinely said no to me is never. No one has ever said, no, I don't want to work with you. It's always like, oh, later, or oh, this person changed the project or something like that.
Rachel, you disgust me. I can't believe you followed. No, like most people aren't looking for a fight. No. And there are people, no joke, who may not have been convinced, but my persistence won them over, and they're like, maybe we should give this guy a shot. Yeah. We can't get him to go away. So maybe we can get him to go away with a project.
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I mean, you have a lot of experience with putting yourself in the line of rejection. So,
well, it's gotta be a core competency. Like, I think the people with the highest tolerance for embarrassment win. Yeah. And it's not even real embarrassment. It's anticipated or like expected embarrassment.
Yeah. You like made it up in your mind.
It's not even real.
It's
like
a story.
Yeah. It hasn't even happened yet. So I'll give you an example. This is slightly different, but one of my coaching clients had put this big pitch out to an agency, and it was by far, like, it was five times bigger than any project he had ever quoted. And then the principal at the agency was like, can we hop on a call and talk about your price? And my client was like, what should I do? Just trepidation,
of course,
you know,
you're
knocking
like freaking
knees.
Out.
Yeah. And I said something to the effect of, think of this principal at the agency as a mentor, someone who will teach you something valuable. If your goal is not to optimize for ego, but instead to optimize for mastery, or just to get better. If you're just interested in getting better, this is an opportunity for you to learn something new. Anyway, as you would probably guess, you know, he wasn't the problem.
Right.
Right. They get on the call and they're like, hey, bad news. Our client actually dialed back our budget. So we need to take you from 5,000 down to 2,000. And that was a little bit discouraging, but he closed the $2,000 project that is still to date the biggest single project fee he's ever charged. And it was for a flat fee, not for hourly. And he's stoked, and it's a new offer that he's really excited about. And all of that because he... And it was hard, yeah. But he didn't take it personal.
Yeah, exactly. If you make business personal, A, it becomes really heavy. B, burnout is just always lurking. And then C, it's like, it's not really very fun. Like, it kind of hurts your feelings all the time if you're taking your business
all the time
personally.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I mean, I'm a sensitive person, and I spent years secretly believing that there wasn't really a place for a sensitive person like me in business. Yeah. Then, through some growth and probably healing too, I realized that, oh no, sensitivity is one of my superpowers. It's what enables me to do, you know, high quality, even excellent creative work. It's what enables me with consulting to pick up on contradictions, inconsistencies, problems, right? And so I need this. And yet there is, again, a core competency that has to be, you have to develop all around. Hey, if you reach out to somebody, you send that cold letter of introduction or cold pitch, and then you don't hear back. just tell yourself it has nothing to do with you or your pitch.
It genuinely doesn't. It doesn't even have to be like a story. Like, it's just the truth that just means nothing about you at all. Yeah. It's just timing. Timing is everything. And you can't know the timing until it happens. So can't pretend that you can like predict the future, you know? I was just talking to my friend the other day about the separation I have with my emotions. Like, I am also a very sensitive person. But I don't like to ascribe anything to my emotions when I'm at work because it makes the job heavier, just like taking it personally does. And I was like, man, I'm really tired today, but I really got to get these projects done. Like, I just have too much on my plate. I'm feeling a little overbooked right now, but you know, I just got to get through it today. And he was like, wow, yeah, it sounds like you're having a really shitty day. And I was like, what?
And you're like, no, this is, this is actually just average. Like, this is normal.
Like, this is just, these aren't good or bad. It's just neutral. It's just facts. I'm tired. So after my 2 p.m. call, I'm going to take a quick nap and then I'm going to get back to it. It's just a signal to my brain that, like, maybe we need to slow down for a second. It doesn't mean it's bad.
Well, and what sensitive people do is actually infuse lots of things with meaning. And again, it's a superpower because sometimes you're picking up on the subtext in a conversation. If you're a high empath and you realize a friend of yours is hurting, you can be like, hey, you were really quiet tonight. Is there anything you want to talk about? If I'm happy to listen, right? That's a superpower. It's a beautiful thing to show up that way for the people in your life. But in business... You know, be like, well, how dare he say that over an email? I have I had come from a long line of highly sarcastic
people. Oh, no.
And I've realized that, like, when, like, first of all, do not use snark in business.
Never.
Snark is bad business. Yes. Unless I'm being silly in the content I create. Yeah. But even when I have, I've had several clients over the years that they will slide in a little bit of snark. Very best thing to do is ignore.
Totally, yes.
And respond matter-of-factly to emails, to comments, but I want to say one thing before we move on. You know, we were talking about, like, try not to take it personally. Yeah. Also, be very, very cautious with anyone who tells you about business, it's not personal. Business is always personal. Robots don't do business. Right. It's people doing business with other people.
And it is your income.
Always personal.
And like, yes. This is like when I talk about networking, I'm like, it is personal. Like, treat it personally. Like, pick something out from their profile when you send a connection request on LinkedIn and mention it. Like, P.S. I love that you featured your cat in your latest post or whatever.
And you'll see your connection acceptance go way up.
And but just like a human being. Like, treat them like a human being. That's what we're here for. That's what you want, right?
That's right. So don't take things too personally. But meanwhile, just like proceed with caution when you meet people who are like, hey, it's nothing personal. They're about to do something that is probably... People only really preface what they're about to do with that when they're doing something to you that they wouldn't want you to do to them. So some sort of unfairness always follows that. Anyway, exactly. That's a nuance. We can talk about
it. I like this little red flag. That's a LinkedIn post right there. Well, now that we're like 11 minutes into this podcast episode, would you mind introducing yourself real quick? Because we did not do that.
That's funny. Yes, my name is Austin L. Church. I use the pretentious middle initial so I don't get confused with all of the churches in Austin, Texas online. That was one of my like more forward-thinking choices.
I was wondering about that because on your LinkedIn profile it has the L and I was like, I wonder why he uses his middle name. And I literally never thought of that, but now I see it. Now I really see it. Oh.
Rachel, it is a pro tip on LinkedIn because when you get these horrible, like dirty diaper pitches in your DMs, I know that they're using some tech stack to just blast stuff out. And I got included because it'll be like, hey, Austin L, do you want 24 more qualified leads per month and you only get paid when you close?
Yeah.
Or we only get paid when you close? And I'm like, if they use my middle initial,
you know it's messed
when
up.
They send the message, instant ignore you, instant delete. Mm. So it's a nice little parsing tool.
I like that. That I
found. But so I started freelancing in 2009. I did not have to have any courage because I got laid off from my job at a marketing agency. Well, I take that back. I had to have a little courage the next week to get out of bed and be like, I don't even really know what freelancing is. Because it was honestly, it was less of a thing in 2009.
It really was, yeah.
It was just like being independent. But I was a writer, am a writer. That was my entree into fun employment. And one thing kind of led to another. I was always pretty good with strategy. I just liked getting better results. And so I got into branding. I got into mobile apps. Mm. Eventually co-founded and invested in a tech startup and had an agency for a hot minute with staff. Now I split my time between marketing consulting and business coaching for freelancers who have passed the 100K mark. So that's a little bit about me.
Perfect.
That's 15 years in about 20 seconds.
I, as someone who is on the cusp, but we'll obviously talk about freelancing and stuff, but what just caught my eye is the agency bit. I'm working on starting an agency.
Right on.
And I would love to hear more about your experience.
So I can give you a couple of beliefs, right? Number one, this is a false belief, and we built our agency around the opposite. The false belief was that more time invested leads to better creative outcomes. Mm. Now, that can be true. So for example, I'm working on a book right now about freelance pricing and money mindset. And it's true that pieces of the book that I've edited more are better, right? They're like these finely polished jewels now. I love where those pieces are at because I put more time in. But generally speaking, if you're continuing to sink more and more and more time into a writing project or an identity design project or a web design project, you're usually using time as a surrogate for sturdy process.
Mm.
So brilliant creative outcomes don't just come from putting more time in.
Yeah.
Right. And now a lot of us who come from an arts and liberal arts background, we're like, oh no, I need my creative time and kind of fight for a loosey-goosey approach.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that was one of the first commitments we made is like, we don't believe that a loosey-goosey approach, which ultimately means inefficiency in sinking our time in, we don't believe that better serves our clients or will create better projects for our portfolio. The second one is kind of related. It's not brilliant creatives who create brilliant creative outcomes. Oh, wait. Yeah, sure. Sometimes they do. But back to our earlier conversation about sensitivity, and if I'm honest, my own moodiness, you don't want to build an agency with this single point of failure around like brilliant creatives who can just have off days or leave the agency.
You want to build it around consistent people.
Build it around consistent process.
Yeah.
So you see the compound effect when you get highly capable people and you give them robust process. And when you combine those two things, not only is the consistency better from the client standpoint, but you can scale.
Yes. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You cannot scale a single brilliant creative person because they're going to reach capacity.
Yeah.
But if you put someone who's like junior or like, let's be honest, they're like a B talent level, but you give them an A plus process, you'll get an A minus outcome, which is more than satisfactory from the client's standpoint. So ironically, the thing that I'm most proud of during our agency days is like we actually built the agency the right way by focusing on standard operating procedures, having good checklists, having good templates, having like dialed in brand development exercises, and really building something that could scale without driving us crazy.
Yeah, cool. I like to hear that. Why did you decide to stop doing the agency?
So my co-founder and business partner needed to go get a full-time job. That was kind of on both of us because we didn't keep enough leads in our pipeline. So it was ultimately a pipeline problem. And when things slowed down, you know, he needed to leave because he needed to make more money for his family. And I cared about him. We're still friends. So like, that's part of the reason I'm proud of that season. It's like, what mattered most to me was preserving the friendship, and we did that successfully. But that was the biggest thing. We had work just thrown at us for the first 18 months. Yeah. And we got fat and happy. We kind of fell asleep on the marketing front. And by the time we really need to fire up the marketing engine, it was too late.
Yeah. Once you actually, and I think this is true of like being a solo freelancer as well. Once you need clients, it's too late to do the marketing. Like you should be doing the marketing regardless of whether you need clients or not.
Yes.
I was like perusing your website and
thank you for your honesty.
The like morning marketing habits is so, I talk to my freelancers all the time about this. And one of my clients, Polly, has actually like, she went from 0 to 400 subscribers on her email list because she implemented a morning marketing habit. And it's such a game changer. And it's literally like you can spend 30 minutes. You can spend an hour. It doesn't have to be a lot of time. And your life will change. Your leads will change if you just focus for like a short amount of time every day.
Well, I mean, now you're speaking. No, but like I think a lot of us, we kind of sit on our hands and hope that our dream clients will just show up out of the blue. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, there is this dream business that we have in our minds and we have in our hearts. And we'd really love to do this type of work for this type of client. Well, most of the time, they're not just going to come to you because they don't know you exist. Yeah. Right. So, yeah, you will receive more inbound leads if you've spent the time to become a recognized authority in a specific niche. But if you are relatively anonymous, it's up to you to go, as one of my mentors said, go get in the way of opportunity. Mm-hmm. And so a morning marketing habit is trying to break up that big and kind of intimidating goal of how do I connect with enough clients that I really want to build the business I really want. Well, you break that up into a more manageable goal of, well, I can't always control the results. I can control the input or the habit. If I build a morning marketing habit, then I actually have less anxiety kind of spread across my work. Because, and I called a morning marketing habit because I just had too many days where if I said, I'll get to that in the afternoon, it's kind of like fitness. Yes. It's like working out, you know?
That only works if you have a class or an accountability buddy. You know what I mean? Yep.
Like, yeah, you can work out at 4 p.m. if you're going to leave your bestie, your gym bestie hanging, but the single best way I know of to transform your freelancer consulting business is to adopt a morning marketing habit and make it non-negotiable. And then this is the big breakthrough for me. The main problem that we have is unpredictable income. You asked, hey, what killed the agency? It was that.
Yeah, totally. And regular freelancers have that problem too. Like solo people have that problem too. Yes. Big time. Yeah.
So what is the opposite of unpredictable income? Well, it would be a surplus of project leads.
And also like knowing your rates for those leads so that you can predict it. Like, I have a whole dashboard that I created. I share the template with freelancers. It's in Notion. And I have a whole column called planning. And you just plan, like, once you've had a discovery call with a client and you talk about what package they probably want, you put it in the planning column. And now you know, like, this is coming next. I will make enough money next month. And I didn't have that when I started. Yes. And it's like every day of my life, I was just like churning that whole first year or two, just stressed about money and like trying to make. I remember when I was trying to work up to making $3,000 a month, which felt like so impossible at the beginning.
Yeah, it's way up. Way up in the ether. It's like impossible to reach.
Yeah. Right? And now it's like I'm planning for 10K months and I'm constantly planning. And that's what it takes, is like planning and looking ahead and getting people coming down the funnel for sure.
Well, most of us did not get into freelancing to become marketers.
True.
And yet, if there's one core competency you could develop that will just reward you handsomely for decades, it would be becoming really good at lead generation, because if you generate a surplus of leads, a lot of your other downstream problems just disappear. Like, if you're generating a surplus of leads, you become more selective, you raise your prices, you make the money you need to make in fewer hours because you're charging more and your effective hourly rate goes up. Maybe you hire an assistant. Maybe you start farming out bits and pieces of projects to like other freelancers. Maybe you scale up into a lean agency. But if you think about it, the single upstream sort of big boulder problem is inconsistent income, unpredictable freelance income. Okay, what are you going to do about that? And that was one of the reasons I created the Morning Marketing Habit course and tried to keep it affordable, was this is just a perennial problem that we all have, and I've found a reliable solution. And I hope people will do
it. I like it.
You know, like, go do it. You don't even need my course.
You can literally just hop on LinkedIn every day. Let's go.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know.
Yeah, yeah. No.
Pick something and then keep doing it every day.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. That's great. I like to hear it. We talk about this kind of stuff a lot with my coaching clients as well and in that community. What would you say? You're talking a lot about core competencies. I feel like we touched on a couple: persistence, not taking things personally, marketing. Do you think there's like a top five, like there's two more that would really resonate?
So I tend to think in levers, right? Levers get you better results with less effort. And I see six of them.
Okay.
And so marketing or pipeline is one of them, right? If you can become adept at lead generation, well, you really make your life easier down the road, right? Another one is positioning, right? There are so many freelancers now, so many consultants. How are you going to stand out? If you stand out, specifically if you have authority in your niche, then you make your life easier, right? You get more leverage. Another one is packaging, or another way to put it is offers, right? Like, there are tons of copywriters or graphic designers or visual identity designers or Webflow web designers, right? WordPress developers, like, there are tons of people with a similar comparable skill set. So how are you taking your core service offering, packaging it up as a juicy offer, increasing the attractiveness of it, the perceived value of it? Tons of leverage in that, right? Because functionally your package may be very similar to another freelancer's in terms of what the client gets. But if the packaging is so much more attractive, like, it's sort of like labels on a wine bottle.
Yeah, totally.
I
was just thinking products in my head of that are comparable. Yeah, like, and I'm like, oh yeah, you know, it's like the Stanley Cup versus like the Hydro Flask travel cup. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
We're all going for that Hydro Flask, right?
Well, because I think there's something to be said for like how good packaging, again, elevates the perceived value. So that's why packaging or your offers as distinct from your services, that is a lever, right? Another one is your price, right? Like if you can make more money in less time, you ease up pressures in other parts of your freelance business. And I have found that many of my clients who paid more for this or that are actually more satisfied.
Yeah.
So we have to get out of the scarcity mindset that says, well, if I charge more for the same amount of work, then someone loses. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, that's not my experience. No. My experience is that pricing is positioning, pricing is branding. Would you rather be Rolex or Timex? Functionally, they do the same thing, but people show more respect to the Rolex because it's more expensive. So
yeah, do you find
pricing is a huge lever?
I think it's nice to hear you say that like pricing is positioning. That's like a beautiful little phrase right there that you can package up because people get so emotional about money. Like when I first started, I didn't feel like I'd never made more than $18 an hour. I didn't.
None of us
right.
did.
And it feels outlandishly crazy to walk in and be like, yeah, pay me $30 an hour, pay me $50 an hour. Yes. And it's not. But like you have to get used to one of my previous podcast guests called it ooching. Like you slowly move like a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more, like raise your rate 10% with each client and eventually you'll get to where you're going. Or just like there's so many mindset things around money and it's so frustrating because the simple fact is pricing is positioning. But then underneath that, it's like an iceberg. It's like the top is that statement. And then underneath it is like all of these emotions and mindset stuff and all the stories you've told yourself and your life experience.
So 100%, right? And like, so when I was working on this book that I'm like this close to finish, like the publisher has the manuscript now. And I'm like, I can't believe it. Anyway, there was like, I ended up adding a whole section on money mindset. Because when it comes time to ooch, like when it comes time to like make that next incremental increase, you're going to have all of this programming come crashing in. Oh, well, you know, I'm already making enough. Shouldn't I be content? Or, you know, my dad never, I had this one coaching client. And she was struggling to raise her rates because she was thinking, how would my father feel if he found out what I'm charging now? Because I stand to make more in a month than he used to make in a year.
Yeah. And he probably founded his personality on hard work.
And so it's like another day, another dollar. So I get deep into that like coin purse of cultural axioms that were like, so wait, if I enjoy the work and it comes naturally to me, it doesn't feel hard and I'm able to do it quickly and I get paid a crap ton of money, well, I must be exploiting.
Where's the problem?
Right. No, but seriously, but like we grapple with this stuff because we've never made the unconscious conscious by putting our beliefs about money on the table and then being like, well, is that true? Can I find something else that is equally true or more true?
Yeah.
So it's true that as soon as you start trying to raise your prices, there are all these like sticky spider webs that are like stretchy. And you're like, wait, this is getting held up by something. You know, this ooching, this unit of ooching is now, it's emotional. Money's emotional. And again, once you recognize that, you can begin to like upgrade your beliefs and we can't outperform our beliefs, right? So if you're not where you want to be with your prices, chances are you need to reexamine your beliefs about money.
Yeah, big time. I made a whole workbook. I like offer it for free because I've just found it to be like just so foundational. And it's one of those workbooks that even I go back and use it. Like I'll go back like every year when my price.
I promise I'm making this for everyone else.
Right? I'm like, this is 90% for me. Because I've taken a bunch of courses because that's what you do with upskilling. And one of them, the like most recent one I took had a money mindset, an entire chapter about it. And I was like, wow, they're dedicating like 7 lessons and a workbook to this? Really? And then I finally did it and I was like, wow, what is wrong with me? And then like 3 months later, I hit my first 10K month. And it's so important.
No coincidence, right?
Yeah, it's so meaningful. It really is.
Yeah. I think one of the biggest ones for me was like art and commerce don't mix. And that if I have these beautiful creative skills, then I ought to feel bad about using them to make money, or at least bringing them into the world of commerce and using them to help other people make money. And then you go back and look like across history and I'm like, I don't think like artists before, well, we could really get into the history, but we won't. But like it used to be that if you had creative art or artistic skills, like, okay, that's what I have. So I'm going to go out and figure out how to like take care of my family with these. And there wasn't so much stigma attached to taking these skills, like, and putting them in service of like a prince or a king or a wealthy patron or someone who could afford to pay you to create a painting, because websites didn't exist back then, right?
But, and all, like, no. Capitalism is the main driver of that icky feeling.
100%. Yeah. And so even looking at capitalism, you're like, do I believe in a limited pie world where if I raise my prices, I'm getting a bigger slice of the pie, and that necessarily means someone else's slice just got smaller. That is fixed mindset.
It's not real.
That's not how wealth
works. The government prints money, man. Also, have you seen the housing market? Like, that's not real. Like, we're building houses. Real. Prices of houses are still going up. Prices of houses go down. Like, yeah, there's so many examples of it. That's really, it's just a belief.
Well, and so the last two levers are psychology.
Uh-huh.
And process. Again, you can't outperform your beliefs. And so if you look at another freelancer and you're like, I'm just as good as she is. And then you find out through the grapevine that she's making like, she's averaging like 25K a month. Mm-hmm. And you're at like 8K a month. And you're like, skill wise, is she 4 times better than, is she quantifiably 400% better than me? And you're like, well, no. Okay, then what is she thinking, believing, and doing differently? And might you benefit from figuring that out and employing some of the same things, assuming that they are scrupulous, ethical, you know? But there is so much psychology entwined in all of this. And again, once you realize, oh, belief is a huge part of it. Sky's the limit.
Yeah. It's incredible how much your brain, I mean, you're using your brain all day to do your job as a writer, but we don't think about every part of the brain necessarily. And that's, it's important to think about those underlying details. I've also noticed when I start to have that feeling of like, that girl has what I want, why don't I have it? Instead of feeling envious or comparing myself, that thought process of like, what do they have? But then taking it a step further and like actually reaching out to that person, they might not want to talk to you. That's fine. Maybe they don't. But the amount of friends that I've made from that and the things that I have learned and the like leaps and bounds I've been able to take in my business because I saw someone who was making 25K a month doing exactly the same services that I'm doing and getting clients that I was like, I never thought I could get, completely changed the trajectory of my business. Because the first like 2 or 3 years, I just spent the whole time being jealous of other people.
Well, yeah.
And it's just going to hold you back.
Because you believe, or I believe, or we believe when we look at other people that there's a secret, they know it, or there's some kind of X factor or hidden advantage that they have that is inaccessible to us. And therefore, their results are inaccessible to us. And here's the thing. I think it actually really helps, to your point, getting to know one of those people you put up on a pedestal. And then when you get to know them, you might realize, like, oh, it's not that you are some freak of nature when it comes to this. Yeah. It's that you are fearless when it comes to sending out pitches. Or it's that you saved up an emergency fund, which gave you walkaway power. So you stopped saying yes to low-paying projects. And within 3 months, because you had extra time that wasn't tied up with low-paying projects, you finally got your marketing going. And then you created a virtuous cycle. Like, once you get to know these people, you demystify, like, their, I hate to even use the word success, but let's say results. And then you're like, oh, it's just strategy and patience.
Yeah.
Like, that's, oh, okay. I can do that. I call them negative mentors. Even if you like them, it helps to find a mentor who isn't like a world-class, you know, Mensa intellect, and be like, okay, I'm just as smart as she is and just as capable. I need better strategy and I need more patience.
Yeah. And surrounding, I mean, I think that's why they say surround yourself with the people that you want to be like, because you learn these things by osmosis and being able to ask some questions. And, you know, they might not have to be your friend, but
it's another reason to have a podcast. Right?
Exactly.
Like, it can be like free consulting where you're like, yes, this is definitely for my audience and not for me.
My whole reason for starting that, I started this podcast when I finished the Appalachian Trail, because I listened to so many podcasts on the AT and I heard, like, I just learned so much and I felt like I could really become a better person with all of these things that I was learning. And it really made me believe, like, oh yeah, I can go out and just like start my own business and I'm just going to do it tomorrow. And this is what I'm going to do. It. If I can hike this whole trail and listen to these podcasts, I am good.
I've already done hard things.
Exactly. Right? But then there is also this factor of like, oh, I could talk to anyone I want, even if they seem mildly social media famous. Okay. Mm-hmm. It just like gives you an excuse to talk to these people that you can learn a lot from, really.
And here's the thing. These days, it's crazy. We don't even really need a podcast as a forcing function or an excuse.
Like, coffee dates are a thing.
It's just wild that you could just email somebody and the worst they can do is ignore you, but sometimes they'll surprise you and they'll say, I emailed Seth Godin once to ask him if I could take him out to lunch and he rejected me and it stung. But I'm like, it was also kind of like, well, he did reply.
Yeah.
That's something.
Wow. That's ballsy. Okay.
Reach out to random people.
Just reach out.
Like, that's another reason to get on their email newsletters, right? Is like, just reply one day and be like, can I take you out to lunch? You never know.
I love when people very rarely reply to my newsletters, but when they do, I'm like, oh my God, someone replied to my newsletter.
Oh, hello, friend.
Yeah, so exciting. Okay, so tell me about this book. Or is this something that you did like through a publisher and you got like your upfront and your like publishing physical copies, or is this something else?
So this is definitely a physical copies book. There will be hardback. There will be paperback. It's through Tilt Publishing. And so they are like a strategic partner of Lulu Press.
Okay.
Lulu Press is a direct competitor with Amazon's CreateSpace. So Tilt is going to end up being more of a hybrid publisher, where if you're an entrepreneurial author who either has no interest in going the traditional route, trying to get a literary agent, trying to shop around a manuscript, you know, hopefully start a bidding process with a publisher, get an advance. So I got an advance of sorts, but it was like a little bit different because it was more like a sponsorship where they just said, hey, we like you. We like what you're writing about. And we would like for you to naturally mention that we're helping you with this book. Again, naturally, not in a way that seems too overtly promotional. I've loved working with them. Cool. Their team is delightful. Nothing but positive things to say. And I'm really pleased I've gone this route. And I literally delivered the manuscript to them Tuesday. Mm-hmm. So it is crazy fresh in terms of like, oh, I'll be holding a book in my hands pretty soon.
Yeah. How different did it feel? You've made courses, you've done coaching. Now, like, I feel like a book is different.
It is in part, it feels more vulnerable.
How so?
Because I care about like my writing more than I care. Like a course is something that if you don't like how one of the videos turns out, you can always just substitute a better video. Mm-hmm. Right. And courses are ostensibly about like just conveying information. Mm-hmm. But when I was a kid think, you know, I'm going to be a course creator when I grow up.
Was your voice that deep as a kid?
Yes. I never went through college. No, it was always like, no, but I always wanted to write books. And so this felt consequential. Mm-hmm. It felt more significant. That's something else I needed to move past. It's like a book has to be your first. This is my first, I've written published a children's book, but this is my like first grown-up book, business nonfiction book. And so I had to keep on reminding myself, it's going to be my first book. It's going to have blemishes. But I do think it's going to help a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So that's what kind of pulled me through some of my insecurity around, and honestly, like obsessive perfectionistic fiddling with things. You have to finish it. So it's taken more time than anything else I've ever created. It's really hard to hack a book, even with something like ChatGPT.
Yeah, right? Obviously.
But even once I finished the manuscript, then I had to go through developmental editing and then line editing and proofreading. And then now we're in the typesetting phase. Meanwhile, I'm working on getting the website up, working on book cover design. So it's just a bigger project than anything I've ever done. And that's why it's been different. Yeah. It was tied into my, ironically, now that I'm finishing it, it's less important to my identity.
Interesting.
How funny
is
that?
Yeah, well, you worked through the things that you had tied up in your identity and your mindset and all those things as you wrote it, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Interesting.
You have to let it go eventually. You have to do the best you can, put it out into the world. And like I said, believe that if I really care about like precipitating transformation for other people, and I believe they need this process and they need the message in it, I have to get over myself.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Nice. What is the book about?
So the book's called Free Money. And the first half or the first part is a pricing process for identifying what I see as the 7 numbers that you need to know in order to have prices that both cover your immediate needs and move you definitively toward your long-term financial and lifestyle goals, right? So a lot of us, we don't have any classes about pricing in college or in high school. How much do you charge for writing, right? And so we sort of blindly imitate other people, and they may have very different needs or goals. So you ask what the book is about. It's about how do I come up with prices that I'm confident mm-hmm. in. So that's the first piece, is like, here's how to do it. Step one, step two, step three, right? You have these 7 numbers. The 3 most important ones are your dream rate, your pessimistic price, mm-hmm. and then your weirdly precise number. I don't think we have time to go into each of them, but if you arrive at the dream rate and then you turn that into a pessimistic price and then you put the weirdly precise number on top of that, that price for that project will feel very exciting.
Yes.
When you get a yes for it. The second part of the book, the first part of the book is about pricing. The second part of the book is about earning. Like, how do you take that price and then go out into the marketplace and actually command that price, like win a project at that price. So there it starts with wayfinding. Like, we're much better at negotiation and self-advocacy when we know what the money is for. So what is the money for? What does it symbolize for you? Right? If you're like, hey, I want to buy my first house. We were talking about the crazy housing market.
Yeah.
Earlier. Like, hey, I'm saving up for a deposit on my first house. Right? And so the next time someone tries to talk you down on price, if you have an emotional connection with what the extra money represents for you, you will be more effective, right? So there's a chapter on that. There's a chapter on money mindset, upgrading your beliefs. There is FAQ. So I get a lot of the same questions about money over and over and over again. And I'm like, I'm just going to answer those in a book.
That's a great idea.
That seems helpful, right? There's a chapter about what I call vitamins, which are principles, best practices, techniques. You have your price. Again, how do you go get that? And then the final chapter in the book is what I call victory lap. It's the same pricing process from the first half, but distilled way down because, surprise, you're going to have to keep changing your prices over the course of your career. I don't think you necessarily want to read my book again every time you raise your price. So I'm like, here, I'll tuck this at the end. And then the in the appendix is another important piece, which is the six or seven most common pricing models for freelancers and consultants, the pros and cons of each one.
Cool.
So I'm excited.
This is a lot of information that would be very helpful for someone who's new to this. Or actually someone who's experienced too.
It's all wrapped up in some dad jokes. So I did, like, my goal was a short, helpful, entertaining book.
Good.
That, like, I want people to get even through the end of the first section and be like, where has this been my whole freelance life?
Yeah.
Right.
Cool. Yeah. I like, I obviously was stalking you earlier, and you do tend to make a lot of like dad jokes and inject your personality into the copywriting on your websites. And I really
can't
like
help
that.
It. Like, this will give you an example. Like, naturally we need to like talk about clients and how they kind of show up in these interactions. And one of my go-to client avatars in the book is Bobby Boogerface. And it's so juvenile. And I know that, but it's a freaking, the first half is a freaking pricing manual.
It's so serious.
Pretty dry. Yeah. And so it's like, how do we add some levity and some fun? So I did my best to just be like, what? I want to make this part of the book bearable or even delightful. So thank you, Bobby Boogerface, for your help, with that.
Oh, that's so good. There is one other thing I wanted to talk to you about since we have a couple minutes. One of the things that you seem to have in like every single one of your curriculums is the whole work-life balance. And I feel like you obviously display that in your life. Like, you have kids, you have a family. What does that look like for you? And how do you sort of distill that for other freelancers to like just start thinking about how to make your work-life balance work more better for you? You know what I mean?
Yeah. So I think if you went back a couple of hundred years, this concept would be confusing to people because it's just life. So it's only been recently and in the West where this idea that work would ever be in competition with the rest of your life even became a thing. That said, I think blend or harmony are better words than balance, because work-life balance assumes that there is like a perfect state we're optimizing for. And I have found that like stuff happens.
It's not realistic.
Like the only, and so you're just, there are always going to be seasons of life where you're working more than you feel like you should. There are going to be seasons of life where you have to dial back for your health or for relationships or for travel or fun or whatever. So the way I think about it is, I'm going to optimize for an effective hourly rate. I'm going to be trying as much as I can to make, to hit my target monthly income with only 20 billable hours a week. It may take a while to get there for a lot of people, but then if you want to spend more time beyond that, working on the business, pursuing other ideas, great. But your business can't love you back. So, and there's more to life than work, and there's more to work than money. Mm-hmm. So
did you read that book, Work Won't Love You Back?
No,
I haven't. That's so funny that you just said that. Yes, you should read it. It's good. I mean, I feel like you probably already know everything in it because you seem to work pretty hard on that harmony. But yeah, I think it's a real eye-opener for people in corporate life especially. There's something to be said. Like, I was listening to a podcast the other day about how over the past basically century, private schools have changed, private colleges and private high schools and things like that. And part of it is changing our, it's that fact is changing our workforce. Like, people are working harder than ever to attain higher salaries. Like, lawyers work more hours than they ever have before. Bankers work more hours than they ever have before. We used to have bankers' hours, and now bankers are working all the time. And private schools require more work than they ever have before and are more expensive than they've ever been before. And it's
that's a cycle that becomes self-perpetuating. Yeah,
and it gets worse every year. And I think Work Won't Love You Back is really, like, aimed at that, the people who went through that cycle and are in it now, you know?
Mm. Yeah.
Interesting.
It is.
Well, thank you so much for doing this. I'm excited to read your book when it comes out. And I'm glad that I was persistent with following up with you.
I'm glad you were too, to bring it full circle. This has been a delightful conversation. And I really appreciate the conversation. And, you know, I'll see you online.
Yeah, I'll see you on LinkedIn for sure.
On LinkedIn.
And your newsletter. All right.
That's right. That's right.
One last thing. Anyway. Can you tell people where they can find you online?
Sure. Go to freelancecake.com. And that's where you can subscribe to my newsletter. There is a page there where you can check out the book, join the waiting list, or if it's out by the time you listen to this, buy it. Or find me on LinkedIn, Austin L. Church, pretentious middle initial, right? But yeah, I'm easy to find on LinkedIn.
Perfect. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you, Rachel. I'll talk to you later.
Bye.
Wow, y'all. There are seriously some amazing nuggets of information in this episode with Austin, and I hope you were able to glean them the way that I was. I feel so inspired and revved up by this conversation. I hope it inspires you to set your rates appropriately and really examine what you're charging. If you want to set your rates with Austin's methods, you can find his book, Free Money, in the description of this podcast episode. I hope to see you next week on the guidebook, and I'll see you around the Meltzer Seltzerverse, which, by the way, if you don't know what else is in the Meltzer Seltzerverse, you should also check the description of this episode. We have a ton of free resources, some downloadable workbooks and checklists. We have my free course coming out on YouTube. We also have our membership community for freelance writers called Pop Club, and so much more. So check it out. This podcast was created by Rachel Meltzer and edited by Matthew Usherwood.
The music is by Ketza from the Free Music Archive.
You can find more information in the show notes below. P.S. Did you know that I offer coaching for freelance writers? You can find more information on store.meltzerseltzer.com. That's store.meltzerseltzer.com. MeltzerSeltzer.com.